Welcome to Econ Talk, Conversations for the Curious, part of the Library of Economics and Liberty. I'm your host, Russ Roberts of Shalem College in Jerusalem and Stanford University's Hoover Institution. Go to econtalk.org where you can subscribe, comment on this episode, and find links and other information related to today's conversation. You'll also find our archives with every episode we've done going back to 2006. Our email address is mail@econtalk.org. We'd love to hear from you. Today is December 1st, 2021, and my guest is the inimitable Michael Munger of Duke University. This is Mike's 40th, yes, count them, 40th appearance on Econ Talk, easily all-time record for most appearances on the program by a guest. He was last here in August of 2021 talking about free markets. Mike, welcome back to Econ Talk.
It is great to be on Econ Talk. Thank you.
Our topic for today is constitutions. Changing constitutions, doing without them, writing one, whether they're important. And we're going to start with a little bit of, for background, the role that constitutions play in the theory of public choice. And we might start by reminding reader, listeners and viewers what public choice is, since it's a term that sounds like one thing and isn't quite the same to you and me. So why don't you begin?
Well, remember, the origins of public choice were the Committee on Non-Market Decision-Making. And in fact, that was the original name of the journal. And to be fair, they were right. That's even clunkier and more meaningless than public choice. So it's true that choosing public choice was an improvement, but that's only because committee or papers in non-market decision-making is even worse. The usual account of the origins of public choice is as Alistair Cook put it on BBC4 upon the occasion of Buchanan winning the Nobel Prize, the homely but true observation that politicians, after all, are very much like you and me. That is, that they're self-interested and that we should not assume that they're angelic or more, they're smarter. They might be, but we shouldn't assume that as the justification for the state. And that is, in fact, an important part of public choice. But the real origins of public choice, and particularly the first of what we now think of as the public choice Pentateuch, the five founding books of public choice, was the calculus of consent. And the calculus of consent takes up some of the work
written by...
It was written by James Buchanan and Gordon Tullock and was published in 1962. So this is right at the origins of what we now think of as public choice. One of Buchanan's heroes was the Swedish economist, political economist, Knut Wicksell. And what Wicksell had said, and it was interesting, was that the only justification for coercion was consent. And we're used to seeing that in bilateral contracts. So when you think about it, if I want you to put a roof on my house, the only way that that can happen is if we have unanimous consent. Now, it's just between me and you.
Meaning,
so two people. I say, I'll pay you $5,000 to put a roof on my house. You think about it. You say yes. And so you agree to put the roof on the house. I agree to pay the $5,000. We have some mechanism of enforcing that. And in fact, we will agree to be coerced. Unless we have some means of ensuring compliance with the agreement, we're actually not free. So a key to liberty is the ability voluntarily to subject yourself to coercion if you violate the terms of the agreement. That's the way we make binding agreements.
And meaning, you said binding agreements when you went out there for a sec. By coercion, you mean if I don't do a good job on the roof, you can take me to court and I might be fined and what money could be taken from me in my bank account. And if you don't pay, I can sue you and you could either go to jail or your wages could be garnished or your house could be seized. Is that correct?
Yes. And those could be solved by reputation. They could be solved by repeat business, but it's much cheaper if we have impersonal exchange. You and I can trade, but it takes unanimous consent. So Buchanan's insight was, and Wicksell's insight was, in that circumstance, most of us have no problem. And in fact, the pro-market people are quite happy with the idea of there being some sort of punishment, or let's call it coercion. It's not exactly the same as but you might go to jail if you defraud me, it might be something worse than I just sue for damages. So most of us, if you violate the agreement, you make a promise, you violate that, we agree that you're going to be subject to coercion and you deserve it. Even the most libertarian anarchist people think coercion is justified under those circumstances.
So the one last thing, you said even anarchists, so it might include me coming, one of us coming to the other's house with a weapon.
Probably we're not going to do that. In division of labor, somebody's going to specialize. So there's a private third-party enforcement agency.
Okay.
And in the contract, we both agree that this third-party private enforcement agency, because they specialize in that, it's easier for them. Division of labor means that they're going to be better at it. They'll have practice. They'll have tools and equipment. So the usual Adam Smith story about division of labor. So it's not the state, but we're going to create.
Could be.
It could be, but even if you think there should be no state, we expect that there would be parties that specialize in the provision of enforcement and violence, provided it is justified by consent.
A prior agreement. And I have to say before we go on that you said this group would specialize and we turn it over to this third party. I find it hard to believe there'd be a third party that could swing a baseball bat, say, at someone's knees better than you could. But okay, fine. I mean, I've seen you on a baseball field. I know you're understanding.
Admit, I would not be a professor. I would be the guy with the baseball bat. That's probably true. I'm not proud of that, but it's true. That's my highest valued use for society. Okay, no, that's not true. So Knut Wicksell said we justify coercion under the circumstances that we have informed consent. And, you know, you have outside options, you have alternatives, you have maybe some right to buy your way out of the contract. So that there's a whole system that allows us to say under those circumstances, coercion is justified. Wicksell said we ought to use the same logic, the same restriction for public goods and collective actions. There's a lot of activities that require more than just two people. That to provide them, there's 3 or 4 or 10 or 50. And so Buchanan, being a redneck from the South like me, used the rather homely example of mosquito control. If your neighbors have a bunch of old spare tires, as of course one does, laying around their property, I do. I have two sitting out back, and they're full of water and mosquitoes. I'm sure my neighbors look at that and say, that bees. Not very public-spirited. So all of us have to participate in this because mosquitoes move around. And so we all promise that we will get rid of all the things that produce mosquitoes on our property. And if we don't do that, we might be subject to at least the censure our neighbors will say, and you know that guy's acting badly. Well, we might even for something where we need to do flood control, we need to build a dam. A lot of us have to agree to contribute to the flood control, but there's the free rider problem. So we might all sign a contract that makes it contingent. I will only pay if everybody else pays, and we will contract with some third-party enforcement agency that anyone who doesn't contribute this fee towards the construction of the flood control berm will be punished. That's beginning to look a lot like taxes, but it's voluntary taxes in the sense we all consented to be taxed, and it's on condition that everybody else pay their taxes also.
So I have to note that I think that's the first use of the word berm in over 800 episodes of Econ Talk. A berm is it has various ways that you can use the word, but it includes a mound of earth that might deter
water. It's a levee,
water,
really, in this context.
Kind of, yep.
So
wait a minute. A long mound of earth. But here's the question: I'm just a jerk. I don't want to be part of this agreement. And I say, you guys build the levee, you guys build the berm. I'm not in. So the rest of you start to wonder, and of course, crosses everyone's mind that they might be that person. Of course, if I want to see at the cocktail party or at the local YMCA or whatever communal things we do together, it's not going to be good for your social life to be that person. But I don't understand the consent coercion thing. The consent coercion thing is that as long as we all agree, we might all agree to be coerced. We might all agree in ex ante, in advance, that we would pledge to contribute the money. And should we renege on that pledge, should we say we changed our minds, we would have signed a document that allowed someone, a third party, private in the first story, but maybe government later, to take that money from us involuntarily. Is that a good summary?
Well, it's a good summary, and you have raised Buchanan's objections to Vixell. So Vixell is saying the only things that we should do are those for which we can get unanimous consent. But someone, and we'll call that person the jerk, might say, the others are inframarginal, and what inframarginal means that it's worth enough to them to pay into this damn fund that I actually don't have to. So I don't consent, and you cannot coerce me if I fail to pay. And I know there's five of us. The other four of you care enough about this that you'll all do it. So we can't actually use literal unanimous consent but we can do that for the contract to put on the roof. If you're a roofer and you say, no, I don't want to do that, it would be ridiculous for me to say, no, you have to. But it's pretty plausible to say if all five of us need to contribute, four of us have agreed, we'll force the other person against their will. The problem is that's a different thing. That's not justified coercion under this system. And so what Buchanan said was it seems like the logic of Vixell's approach is airtight, and that it is, if it's not necessary, it is sufficient. That is, suppose that I have agreed to be coerced if I violate my promise. And then I violate my promise. That probably really does justify coercion. I do justify being punished. So what Buchanan said was we probably cannot use the Vixellian system at the level of outcomes or actual policy, but we could use it at the level of rules. And so what the calculus of consent does is to say, and this actually echoes a famous question that was asked by Rousseau that we have talked on the show about. Rousseau's question was, how can it be said that a man is both free and yet bound by wills not his own? How can it be that a man is both free and yet bound by wills not his own? And so your fifth guy, the jerk, is being bound by wills not his own, because four of us say, no, you have to pay taxes even though you don't want to. And so Rousseau's answer, I think, went off the rails. Please.
Just one clarifying question. It might not be a jerk. It could be a person
he might have perfectly good reasons. That's why like your example.
Let's say he doesn't have a basement. Yeah, but what if he doesn't have a basement? Yeah.
What if he's on high ground?
Yeah, relatively high ground. Yeah. Or just he's poor, and he's decided that a little bit of water in the basement once a year, twice a year, ten times a year is okay with him.
He doesn't need a reason. He doesn't need a reason. He is an autonomous contractor. So whatever his reason, he is entitled to make this decision. That's also a big part of liberty. So that's right. The other four are going to call him a jerk, but he may not be a jerk. That's a good point.
I'm a little bit lost. Before we go back to Rousseau, which I love that quote, and I want you to answer his question. In the case I just mentioned, where one person either jerk or has hit the value of the flood protection is much smaller for that person relative to the 20% share that person is going to have to contribute for out of the five people. What's Buchanan and Wixell saying about that person at that point?
I was about to say, and now I will.
Okay.
So Buchanan said you actually can't use the Vixellian approach. And the answer to Rousseau's question is that the question is not whether you consent to the outcome. The question is whether you consented to the rule by which the outcome was arrived at. So suppose that we have a meeting and we say we have to do a number of things around the neighborhood. Some of them you're going to want to do, some you're not going to want to do, but maybe we can do log rolls, maybe we can make some kind of arrangement. Let's have a thing called a constitution, which is a set of rules about rules. That is, it is the way that we will make decisions. It's not the decisions itself. A constitution is not the decisions itself, although many constitutions are full of conclusions about the way things should be. But a good constitution, by this reasoning, is rules about rules. We're creating decision processes because deciding how to decide is the key.
So in this case, if I were to move into this neighborhood, I might be consenting. It could be a term, part of the term of owning a property in this neighborhood. I would be consenting to submit myself to a rule about when a levy, bad use of word there, L-E-V-Y, a tax.
That's the ambiguity that enriches. It's a levy.
Exactly. It's a levy. A levy will be acceptable to you once you move into this property under the following conditions.
But you
the conditions
skipping,
could be.
You keep skipping
ahead. Well, they could
ahead.
Be unanimity. Well, they could be. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm trying to just help people. Help me see it.
Right, or, but it maybe does, if you'll just let me set the original conditions,
ahead.
Then we will. Because that's, you're right. You're making the perfect point three steps ahead.
Okay, keep going, Mike.
So we have a meeting, the five of us. And we say, this, we are in the state of nature. We are in a condition where we want to make a decision about how to decide things. And there's a lot of problems about doing things unanimously. Let's say that we will require three of the five of us, 60%, and that's true even if there's 100 of us. As it happens, three out of five is a simple majority, but even if our community grows, then it's 60%. A majority is not enough. We're going to use 60%. And we get unanimous consent for that. That is, this neighborhood is constituted to make decisions that are binding on 100% of the people if 60% of the people vote in favor of it. And even if the neighborhood grows to 1,000, 60% is still going to be the rule that we use. And we put that down on a piece of paper, which we call the Constitution, and now we're at your step. We give that piece of paper to all prospective buyers and say, oh, by the way, this is, you are consenting to this if you buy a house in this neighborhood. So,
and that's consenting to be coerced. It's basically
yes.
saying that if there happens to be a project that yields a 60% approval with a referendum, you're going to have to pay, and if you don't pay, we'll coerce you to pay.
Notice that that's the way it often works. I haven't actually tried this argument because I know that it won't happen, but it's tempting. I often drive too fast, and sometimes the police have objections to that, and they want to talk to me. In fact, they insist. They say, we're actually going to talk now. And I could say, you know, I understand there was a vote about the speed limit, but I didn't consent. I wanted 80%. And so I'm actually
80 miles per hour.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I went right. I went 80 miles per hour, and I understand that it's a school zone and the speed limit's 25, but I didn't consent to that, and so not a thing. Not up to the cop. That's not going to work. So I consented to the process by which the rules are decided. And therefore, the rules are binding on me, even if I disagree with the particular outcome.
It's not true that you agreed to the rules. Mike Munger didn't agree to the rules. You were born into a society
You're skipping ahead again.
I'm going to get a very bad grade on this episode, I can tell.
We're in the neighborhood of our five people. And another thing our Constitution said is that we will use 60% to decide the speed limits. And so I consented because I bought property after being handed that piece of paper. And the speed limit says 25 here in the school zone. Now, the question is, does that theory, remember, we're talking about the origins of public choice. So Jim Buchanan, in the calculus of consent with Gordon Tullock, said we should think about constitutions as a set of rules about rules that create binding consent. And it's really important to be able to have consent as a justification for coercion. Now, the question that you just asked, and it's a great one, it's the big one, is there such a thing as tacit consent? Because notice that I've been really careful either to have actual consent of the original constitutors who voted unanimously, or the people who entered knowing, being fully informed of the nature of the rules. But what if you're born into this? So David Hume famously made fun of the idea of, because the tacit consent is the Rousseauian solution. If you're a citizen of the country, if you don't leave, you're bound by the rules. And if you don't like it, leave. That's consent. That's ridiculous. So David Hume said that's like saying you're taken on board a ship asleep. And 100 leagues out at sea, you wake up and you say, I don't want to be on the ship. And the captain said, knock yourself out. Go ahead. Just jump over the side and be devoured by monsters of the sea. Up to you. But if you stay on this ship, you are voluntarily agreeing to my rules, whatever they are. That's not real consent. That doesn't really create coercion. So the reason I have tried to insist we go on this narrow and I probably boring path is that the question is, what is the what, if anything, is the justification for one person to coerce another? And for Buchanan, the only thing that can ever justify coercion is the prior consent of the person being coerced, the actual prior consent of the person being coerced.
So I'm skipping ahead a lot. I apologize. And I'm going to get a bad grade. I'm going to ask for probably either an appeal of the grade or maybe a makeup exam or some extra work I might do to boost it up.
Yeah, there are no provisions for either in the Constitution.
I was going to say, we need a different set of rules for this podcast, obviously. But, you know, I've confessed on here before, I don't know Buchanan and Tulloch. I don't know their work. It's one of the many holes in my reading and not set of knowledge. So right now, you've just summarized Buchanan and Tulloch's calculus of consent by saying that I think that they don't believe in tacit consent. It has to be actual consent. Is that true?
That is sufficient but not necessary for justifying coercion. And so I realize that's a slippery answer.
Okay.
But the question is, what is necessary?
Okay.
And Buchanan actually has a proposition about the status quo. And later in his life, Buchanan became much more skeptical about whether coercion by states could be justified at all. Now, it might be justified by something else, but he didn't think that the existence of a constitution necessarily justified coercion. In fact, he had some questions about whether constitutions really were as valuable as he had said for states. But remember, James Buchanan actually won the Nobel Prize in large part for his work on clubs. So if we have a private club, club goods are those that in my neighborhood, we have four tennis courts and two pools, and you can belong to that club. It is an excludable, that is, you have to pay in order to go in, but non-rival, meaning that the pool doesn't get crowded until there's a lot of people in it. So clubs are sort of social organizations. Nobody could afford, well, most people could not afford four tennis courts, a nice park, and two pools. So collectively, we can privately create this public good of having the racket and pool club. There's a constitution, and you only can go there if you consent to the rules of the club. You can be kicked out of the club, you can quit the club, you can go somewhere else. So that's actually what Buchanan is talking about, is that sort of constitution among private citizens for organizations that are not state. They're voluntary private associations, which is why Alexis de Tocqueville is one of the central figures of this strand of public choice. So the Ostrom seminar room at the University of Indiana, at Indiana University, was called the Tocqueville room. So the Tocqueville and voluntary private associations are the way to think. Those things are constituted. They have small c constitutions in the sense they write an agreement and it's binding, and it creates a justification for coercive response if people violate the rules. But then what about real constitutions with a big C, like the U.S. Constitution? And what about states? What can we say about those?
Okay, good. I think I got it. I'm with you. Totally with you, I think. But you, did you want to say anything else about necessary? Did Buchanan feel he should pay his taxes? I mean, he didn't sign the U.S. Constitution. He was born into this country, never agreed to whatever the marginal tax rate he was stuck with. And went, you know, after he won the Nobel Prize, I'm sure he had to pay a big tax burden. He didn't agree to that. Did he feel justified? Obviously, if he didn't pay it, they'd take him to jail. So they would coerce him. But did he think that kind of coercion to collect taxes was legitimate?
The answer to the question is one of the reasons why you probably have not read much James Buchanan, because he had an extremely frustrating response. And that was, he would invoke the relatively absolute absolutes.
And what are those?
The relatively absolute absolutes are a set of conditions that we accept as the status quo, because the status quo has a special status. Status quo for people is the one outcome that doesn't need a majority, or in fact, it doesn't need anyone to vote for it in order to be binding. So we always start from where we are. And this is actually a Burkean, an Edmund Burke, and you've had Dennis Rasmussen, one of my friend Duke students, on the show a couple of times, I think.
And Yuval Levin talking about Burke.
So Edmund Burke would say that there are binding rules that come down to us from the past, having stood the test of time as ways of organizing our society. And in fact, England doesn't really have a written constitution at all, but it does have a set of rules that have come down to us from the past. Now, we could pass legislation to change these, but by and large, the relatively absolute absolutes are the things that we accept as part of our daily lives, that they're a pretty good way of organizing our lives. And if we want to change them, we can work to change them. But we really have to stick to the status quo. So what Buchanan does is kind of a trick. Instead of saying that we have to justify the level, he says we have to justify the change in the rules. And so it takes our consent to justify a change in the rules because the status quo has a special status. Now, that's really bad. And Hayek has this problem too, where Hayek wants these traditions that come down to us from the past, these habits, these laws, as opposed to legislation, to be binding just because we know that they're right. Well, some of them are wrong. Racism, patriarchy, some of those are really bad. How would you tell? Well, they're relatively absolute absolutes. So we are of two minds about the RAAs. One, we mostly accept them, but scholars, there's nothing that's sacrosanct. So everything is constantly up for questioning and debate, and we can change some of those norms. We can, by statute or actual constitutional provision, get rid of them. So that is certainly the weakest part of Buchanan's theory, is the relatively absolute absolute.
I find that kind of interesting, actually. I don't denigrate it at all.
It's much more in accord with your own view, which is why I think it's weak.
I call that a cheap shot.
Yeah, it was a dirty cheap shot.
I'm going to let it go. Actually, I'm surprised you say that. I do think there's a fund with that. I'm not much of a scholar of ideology in a deep philosophical sense. But clearly, that argument of RAA, relative absolute absolutes. There are no absolutes.
Yeah,
there are
not
some
absolute.
That are relatively absolute.
Yeah.
And that argument is clearly a conservative argument. Mm-hmm. Small, big, I'm not sure what kind of size it is, but a conservative argument versus, let's call it not a liberal, but a radical argument.
Yeah.
The radical says these rules, a lot of them are bad. They lead to bad things. We got to start from scratch.
We should start over. We can do better.
We can do better. And they are correct. We could do better, but it doesn't mean we will do better. That's what makes a person a conservative.
Yeah.
The conservative says it's not just whether every rule is just. What's important, among other things, is civilization. And what civilization requires is a set of expectations so that your will and my will don't clash every single minute. And what norms do, norms are a way, something we've talked about a lot in this program, we'll link to you and me, we'll link to those episodes. What norms do is allow us to lead our lives, meaning it sets the implicit rules of the game without having to have a constitutional convention every day to ask the question, well, things have changed since yesterday. Perhaps it's time for some new rules. That the status quo, even when it's unjust, which inevitably will be.
Absolutely.
And the status quo has a virtue, which is that it's well known. And people do their best in the face of that status quo. Sometimes it means going around. It means avoiding. It means evading. But in a good society, a decent, pretty good society, which is the best you can hope for usually in a large world where it's not five people, but it's 5 million or 50 million or 500 million. In a large world, you can't really fix everything every day. You don't have enough information and you don't have enough rules and you're prone to top-down corruption of power. If you have too much flexibility to move things around constantly, it's going to get hijacked. That maybe this is not a bad starting place many times. And that's just a really interesting idea. I guess it's a way to think about yourself, whether you are fundamentally a conservative or a radical. And as I get older, I am more conservative than right. When I was younger, I think more libertarian than conservative. I would say, yeah, well, we got to start from scratch. I mean, not literally, but there's so many things that we could need to fix.
Yeah.
And lastly, I'm going to invoke one more thing, then it's your turn. The whole idea of the Chesterton fence, which started to make an appearance here on this program like in the last few years, is this really interesting idea that you see something, it doesn't make any sense really. So you say, well, it's a fence. It's in the middle of a field. Let's tear it down. That's why we'd want a fence in the middle of a field.
It's in the way. Literally, it's
in the way.
By definition, it's in the way.
Clear it out and let's allow more freedom and passage. And the Chesterton response is, well, since you don't know why they